I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. Hello, welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks for being with me. I hope that you are having a wonderful Monday. I hope you had a great weekend. And today we're going to be speaking about love cycles, the five essential stages of lasting love. We're going to find out what those stages are, so you want to stay tuned for that, and how we can move through them and maintain the love that we want to keep in our lives. So the author we're going to be speaking with today is Linda Carroll. She's the author of Love Cycles, and she's been a couples therapist for over 30 years. She's certified in transpersonal psychology and imagotherapy, and is a master teacher in pairs therapy. And she lives in Oregon. She has workshops across the country, and you can find her at lindacarroll.com. And there's also a free quiz on lovecycles.org so that you can find out where you might be and what love cycle you might be in your relationship. So welcome to the show, Linda.
Well, hi.
Hi. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be with you today.
All right.
I love talking about love.
Good, me too. I love it too. And yeah, I just loved your book. I read it from cover to cover, and I'm on my second reading now. It's going to be one of those reference books that I keep on my bookshelf and refer back to, I'm sure. So, Linda, what are love cycles? Why did you write this book?
That's okay. Two questions, but okay, let me start with the second question. I was on my way to give a keynote somewhere about relationships and love, and I read this kind of, it was sort of a Dear Abby in a magazine that had been left on the plane. And it was, the question was, somebody wrote in and said, I'm not in love with my husband anymore. What should I do? And the person writing the article, the responder wrote back and said, well, you should find a good lawyer because the relationship is obviously over. And I was so distressed by that, that when I got to the place that I was giving the keynote, I actually opened with that. And I didn't even plan it. I had a whole planned talk. But what happened is, it came out of my mouth was that everything moves in cycles. The seasons of the year, waves on the ocean, our professions, our relationships with family, love relationships are cyclical. And we go through predictable cycles that we know about, and that when in one of those stages that we start with and that we often get into is the feeling of romantic love. But we don't stay in that place. And what happens is that when people move out of that stage and they're not feeling the feelings, they think something's wrong. But there's not something wrong. It's just that we're in a different cycle, and to understand that everything is cyclical, and that having kind of down days and blah days and days we wonder what we're doing with every part of our life, like our professions, those days come. It doesn't mean we quit. It just means that that's a down day. And if we could get some objectivity to understand that love is a feeling, but a long-term relationship is a skill set, and one of those skills is understanding cycles, that I think that there would be a lot more people who could find the promise of their relationship and not bail as soon as they lose the feeling on a particular day, which I think we're pretty encouraged to in our culture.
Absolutely, Linda. That's one of the things that scares me so much about relationships, is that people expect that if you don't have those butterflies and that newness, passionate feeling all the time, or if you lose it for a couple weeks or a couple months, that that's not the right person for you.
That's what the culture says, isn't it? But when you talk to people who have been in long-term relationships, they'll tell you that there are many winters. That there are times of doubt, there are times of struggle. There are times that are just sort of boring, where you just wear the same old clothes and tell the same old stories and feel like, oh, you know, is this all there is? But that doesn't necessarily mean there's something wrong. And in those stages, it seems that the stages are predictable, and we know a lot about them. The stages aren't the problem. The problem is we can do damage when we're in some of those stages. And then that becomes the trouble we have to deal with. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Let's talk about that for a moment. You mentioned at the beginning of the book, the reptilian brain. I think this is a quote. There's no room in the situation for anything but certainty and action when you're in that fight or flight. And that can create a lot of damage.
Yes, that's right. So when we move from romantic love, this is the person of our dreams, and that's the first stage. I'll talk about that we are vulnerable and open and our libido's high, and everything seems to point to the idea that we found this perfect person, all the ways that we fit, and they're safe for us. Because they're looking at us with a great big smile all the time, and we're looking at them with a great big smile, and oh gosh, it feels so great to have somebody welcome you like that. And then what happens is that, you know, we know that first stage is full of chemicals, that our brains actually change, and the part of the brain that changes is the part of the brain that changes with gambling and cocaine and chocolate. So there's a real addictive quality about it, and it lasts 3 years the first time, but it has diminishing returns, so it lasts less and less amount of time, the drugs, the chemistry. When we fall out of that first stage into the stage I call doubt and denial, we move into a power struggle. And then as we're in the power struggle, if you think about how you feel when you go to greet somebody who you know loves you unconditionally, and how wonderful that is. I think that's why we love our dogs and our cats, mm-hmm. Because they just greet us with, you know, everything is forgiven and forgotten.
Does your cat love you unconditionally?
Total welcome. But our lover, after a period of time, you know, does it. Sometimes he looks annoyed or looks stressed out, and it may have nothing to do with us. But there isn't that sense of unconditionality, and we don't have it for them either. What happens is we start to shut ourselves down. We get different chemicals, and the chemicals now, we're wired for connection, which is stage one. We're wired to fall in love. In fact, we call it falling. It doesn't even take an act. It's not an act of consciousness. We fall into it. And we're also wired for protection, not just connection, but protection. And so I walk in to see, you know, I've been with my husband for 30 years. We've been married for 25. And we still go through this when we go away. I have in my mind, when I go away and I go somewhere and I think about him, I always think of the best. I never think of not just the worst, but I never think of the ordinary. It's the best. So I come home, I've been on some amazing trip somewhere, and he's been running our life, and he's sort of, you know, he's working, he's taking care of our animals, he's taking care of sort of the day by day, and I come in, and I'm all expansive, expecting this person who is, in my mind, my ideal partner, and he's sort of grumpy, he's wearing an old shirt, and he sort of, he's, you know, says hi, but not particularly warm and loving. And I'm shocked. I'm thinking, I can't get the two together. So if I know that this is going to happen, and we do know it, and we talk about it now before we see each other, because we know that there's often a miss in how we greet each other. But if I don't know that, I walk in and I think something's wrong, and then I start to shut myself down. My vulnerability goes away. And instead of being vulnerable now, I am sort of defended. Who is he? And we can... And we move, when we're defended, we move into either fight, freeze, or flight. And so at that point, I may withdraw or criticize him in some way, like, oh, I expected more of a welcome. Then he may withdraw or feel criticized. And then we start into a loop. Is this all making sense, how this happens? A power struggle.
Absolutely.
Or he'll say, I've got the kitchen clean for you. And I'll come home and I'll look around, I'll see two cups, and I'll think the kitchen's not clean, because that's my struggle, is that I get very perfectionistic. Okay, so then we start into a power struggle. He'll see me looking at the cup, and he'll say, why would you notice the cup? I spent 2 hours cleaning it. And then we can go off into a loop. It's very different than stage one, where everything was wonderful. So the power struggle, which I call doubt and denial, happens. And at that point, my body is now much more of a closed state. It's not open. It's closed. And his is more closed. And so then we're looking at each other through a different lens. He's no longer this perfect person that's going to make my life wonderful all the time. You know, he's somebody who left the kitchen in a mess and thinks it's clean. So some other part of me then comes out, and he sees me as, rather than this, than appreciative partner, someone who's always finding fault. And then we have another dance that we do. And if we do, and that's part of being human. So the second stage of doubt and denial, the power struggle, happens in our relationships, all of them. And if we can know that it's a part of being human and maintain our humor and our kindness so that we allow that to pass, and then we don't have to create damage in that stage. But not knowing or understanding that it's normal and there's nothing wrong with our relationship, we get reactive. And when people stay reactive for a long time, they can move into the third stage, which is disillusionment.
Okay, can I slow you down for a second?
Yeah.
Linda, because I actually have a question about the moving from the first stage to the second stage.
Go for it, yeah.
So you had mentioned that that addictive quality of the merge stage lasts about 3 years the first time. I just want to ask for some clarification. Do you mean that that's 3 years in the one relationship, or let's say I have another relationship, is it only going to last 2 years with that next partner?
Do you, well, it. I mean, you can't say. I mean, we're all so different. You know, my husband's from New Zealand, and we saw each other once a year for 5 years. So it lasted for 5 years. That's a great way to keep it to last.
Yeah,
is to see each other once a year. But it has diminishing returns because it's a chemical, and every time we fall in love, it takes less and less time before we say, uh-oh. The first time, and that's why a lot of people get stuck in their high school or their college love, the person that they fall in love with first, because it never completes. It gets stuck in the middle so that we always can look back at that and think, oh, you know, that person was so perfect for me, because we're still in stage one with that person. And that's why so many people fall in love in their high school reunions when they're 80 years old. That's another talk. But
that's like people who use heroin, like chasing the dragon, that first
that's
high.
Exactly what
they're
it
always
is.
Trying
that's
to get
so
that
smart.
First high.
That's exactly it.
That's crazy.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, if you want to feel that chemical high without having to do any work for it, because you can get the feelings back, but they don't come free. We don't fall into them. It's a skill set. But if you just want to feel madly in love, you just have to change partners faster and faster all the time. And then you get to feel it, but, you know, then you're in a constant state of distress because you're losing it too.
Wow. All right. Thank you, Linda. So now the next one, we've gone from merge, which is that big butterfly magical, he's the one for me.
That's right, just like that. To doubt and denial. Like.
And then the third one is disillusionment.
Yeah, the disillusionment is, you know, if the first one is enchantment, everything is perfect. Everything is evidence that this is what I've been waiting for all my life. The third one is disenchantment. The opposite. Everything remains evidence, but it's new evidence. It's evidence I shouldn't be with you. This isn't going to work. What was I thinking? We aren't alike at all. In fact, we're so different, I don't know what we ever had in common. And so that's the opposite. You know, they're both trances. One is a halo trance, and the other is a shadow trance. And neither are true. You're not perfect for me. And you're probably not totally imperfect for me either if I chose you, you know. And so what happens is I see there's a selection process that goes on where I can take certain information that I see and it fits into a system and that I make that the truth. And we do that all the time. So in stage three, everything goes into this system that says, uh-oh, wrong person, I better get out of here. And, you know, sometimes it is the wrong person. But I think that the worst time to leave is when you're in stage three, because you can't really see anything but what's wrong. But I'm getting ahead of myself. See, I get so excited about talking about this.
No, this is wonderful. I actually wanted to ask you, and I think this might be the stage that it's in, righteous indignation. I circled it and highlighted it. I mean, I've felt this before too. Can we talk a little bit about that? And I think women can be worse for this than men.
Yeah, that I think that's interesting. I think you're right. Righteous indignation is so addictive, and some of us are more into it than others. But when we have our feelings hurt, you know, if you think about conversations, just think about when you, if you hear two people talking and they're saying, oh, it was such a great party and everyone was so great and it was so nice to see everybody. And then you see another conversation and someone is saying, can you believe what so-and-so did? Can you believe that he would do that to her or that she would do that to him in front of everybody? Which conversation do we go to? The one with the juice in it. Most of us.
Yep.
We're attracted to that. And people join in like, oh, I can't believe how terrible it was. And somehow there's something about feeling righteous, righteously indignant, and in our own relationship to feel the certain kind of glory in our wounds, that can become kind of an addiction too. You know, and I think that's one of the things that's very hard for people to give up when we really do the work and learn the skills. One of those skills is knowing our part of the trouble, and nobody likes that. So I wanted to tell you fast, because people get very resistant to that. What do you mean it's my part of the trouble? You know, if she didn't do such and such, we'd be fine, instead of knowing that we're all, that it's a dynamic, that we're in a dynamic, and that we're both involved in it. So righteous indignation is a way of being the hurt victim and not taking any responsibility for our part of the dynamic, whatever that is.
And this, now, we're talking about this disillusionment. You're saying that these five cycles of love are going to happen. You've seen them time and time again in any relationship that lasts longer.
Yeah, I think they happen many times, actually. And that, and I mean, I think that you don't stay. It's like staying in enlightenment, you know, for people who have a spiritual practice that sometimes will take them to a wonderful place. And there's all those jokes or stories, not jokes, but stories about the person meditating who suddenly one day gets enlightenment. And the master says, and the person says, I just had a Satori experience. And the teacher says, great, now go back and meditate. You know, it's, we get there, we have an experience, but we fall off the mountain. And with love, we get to wholehearted and we learn it, and then we fall off of it again. But we don't get to a certain place and stay there. But we learn the dance, we learn the skills, we learn how to keep our heart into a wholehearted place longer than we used to. And that's, I think, great progress.
There's a story in the book, and we will move on to the next stages, but there was a story in the book that was just beautiful. It actually really, I felt a lot of emotion reading it. It's the story of Dwayne and Charlene, and I'm assuming you changed their names for privacy, with the story about the loons.
Wasn't, you know what, you're the second, only the second person that's brought that up in interviews, and I changed that. So I changed it in so many ways, but you know what? The essence of the story is there, and the loons were there too. It was such a lesson for me. First of all, because I had so much judgment about this guy, and I couldn't imagine why his wife was with him. And my judgment, I mean, as a therapist, that's a horrible thing to admit, but it's true. And I just didn't get it. And he had a lot of judgment about therapy, and he was so angry about having to, quote, take his therapy. And we were from such different worlds. And not only that, he worked in a garage, and he came in with, he never changed his clothes. He'd sit on my couch and leave stains and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So this beautiful thing happened one day with him, which you can share if you want, but I suddenly looked at him, and it was almost magical. He changed in front of my eyes. I suddenly saw how beautiful blue eyes, this kind of gentle poet guy. And I had put this whole story about who he was, that some of what was true, but a lot of it wasn't. And I saw why she loved him, and it was so profound for me, because it wasn't just an awakening to my own judgmentalness, but it was also how there is so much that we don't understand about what goes on between people. And I saw the part of that guy that was really lovable, that was sort of a wild poet, and I really, you know, there was a humility that came into me that day that hasn't left me. And I'm 70 years old, and I've been doing this 35 years, and every year I come to the conclusion I know less than I did the year before. And that was a big time when I came to that conclusion of, I don't know anything. This is so mysterious.
Wow. But what a moment. And there's a few reasons that I wanted to bring that up. And maybe we won't share the story. Maybe people have to buy Love Cycles if they want to hear about the story. But one thing that did happen is it totally changed your perspective of him. And he grew from that experience, and he had a time where he had it. He was sober, he was kind and loving, and he lost it again. And I wanted to touch on that, because we were talking about the impermanence of these cycles and the impermanence of enlightenment.
Yes, that's right. And you know, we lose it again and again, and we have just, and for all of us, we have these moments where we get clarity and where our best self comes out. And, you know, we don't just fall in love in a vacuum. I think what happens with all those chemicals that go on in our body is that we are actually seeing the possibility of the other person. You could say whatever your language is. You could say we're seeing their spirit or their higher self, or, you know, who their essence is. And we fall in love with the promise of that. But then we've got to do a lot of work. We need skills to be able to go through this journey of love and hold on to that essence, or remember it over and over again. Mm. Because when we're defended, it's not your essence that shows up. When we're defended, when we're startled, or when we're protecting ourselves, what shows up is our fight or flight person.
Now, that's interesting, because we will talk about decision in just a moment, which is the next stage. And sometimes people, I mean, we all get into fight or flight when we're triggered for whatever reason. We feel like we have to defend ourselves. And especially once we're out of that magical, addictive merge space, we're more easily put into fight or flight. But what about people who, because what you're teaching is to catch that, to see your reaction before you do some catastrophic damage.
Yeah, to catch it or to recover quickly from it. You know, about a month ago, we were having people to dinner, and I was doing a late interview and in my office, and my husband was cleaning, again, we're back to the kitchen, cleaning the kitchen. And I did this interview, and I was sort of, you know, I was on a roll. You know, I just sort of felt like the goddess of love. I'd been working on this my whole life. I understood it, how to have resilience, how to forgive, how to let go. I hung up from the phone, and I went into the kitchen, and he had done nothing. We were having people over in 5 minutes. I was so angry and upset. And I said, and, you know, actually, he hadn't done it. He had been cooking, but that's another story. But I said, what did you do? And he said, well, what did you mean? And we just got into this really nasty fight very quickly, because we were both anxious. He had a whole reason, which was a very good reason why he hadn't done it. But I went into my fight or flight. He went into his. We got into a nasty fight with each other. And then I started laughing, because we know now that that's not who we are. He said, why are you laughing? I said, because I had this thought that a video was on me, and I just did this whole program all about, you know, getting to wholehearted love, and now we're here like in a cat fight 5 minutes later. And I thought, what if the program suddenly had a video and they were showing me, you know, here I was 2 minutes later having this argument with my husband, and he started laughing, and it was over. I mean, it was maybe 3 minutes. Now, that's the kind of thing that could have gone into something that could have gone on for days at one time. So we fall into it, but we can get out of it if we have humor, if we have goodwill, if we can recognize, you know, that I just went in and attacked him. And so this part of me that can talk about all of this has still not a realized person, that I can get triggered by my own distress. And I care, you know, much more about how the house looks than he does when people come over. So I go into anxiety, and then I go after him. But we can move out, of that very fast. We don't have to get stuck into those places. I don't think we will ever, as humans in relationships, get to a place where, if we're real, that we don't get into some kind of stress and then trouble, you know, because as you go through your life, there's lots of stresses that happen at different stages of life, and they can take you down. Remember, there was another story in there about a couple where they had worked it out. They had done so much work on themselves, and they really had a great relationship. And then they started arguing about who was right, about who had said what, and the arguments got pretty heavy. And then the woman came to the realization that they were in their late 70s. They really were afraid of losing their memory, and the fight wasn't really about who was right. It was really a cry for saying, "Oh my gosh, am I losing it?" And once they understood that, they were able to comfort each other. But it started out by going to that stress place, and then it moved into attack or withdraw.
Well, I just realized we've been talking for a while, and there may be new listeners who have tuned in. So right now we are speaking with Linda Carroll. She's the author of Love Cycles, The 5 Essential Stages of Lasting Love. And she's been working as a couples therapist for over 30 years. She teaches workshops all over the States. And you can also, if you want to find out what love stage you might be in, you can go to her website, lovecycles.org, for a free quiz. This is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and you can find me at spiritualshow.com. And again, the quiz is at lovecycles.org. And it's interesting, Linda, that you were talking about how the couple that was fighting, where they weren't even really fighting about what it seemed like they were fighting about. How
no.
often is that the case?
Probably 98% of the time, that what you're arguing about is really not what you're arguing about. You know, that there's just a few basic things we really need in our relationships, and when we don't get them, we go into protection. And so we argue about what happens is that we have a desire for something, and that desire comes out as a criticism. So one of the things I teach people, one of the skills is how to find the desire under the criticism. So if my partner says to me, you never hold my hand anymore when we go out, that's a criticism. And when I hear that, my first reaction is going to be to defend myself. Well, what about you? You know, you blah, blah, blah. But what is he really saying? He's saying, I want you to touch me. I want you to hold my hand. What happens is that we, rather than being able to say, I miss you, which is such a powerful thing for one person to say to their partner, I miss you. I miss our conversations. What we usually will frame that in a different way, like, you don't talk to me anymore. How come? Which is not very welcoming. So people argue about so many things, which is really has to do with safety. I want to feel like you care about me. My feelings are hurt. I don't understand. And if we can get to what is really underneath, we can save. And those are skills. Those are skill sets that anybody can learn. And that if we can learn how to speak from what's really going on, I talk about it as speaking from vulnerability, although people get kind of scared when I say that. Like I'm asking them to do something that's counterintuitive. But it really is the only way that we're going to get our need met. Because what happens is we fall in love, we feel joined and connected, we feel affirmed and cared about by this other person, this big smile on their face, and then life comes in and takes over, and stress comes in, and suddenly we're sharing a life, so we don't have this safe place to go to, and we're seeing other reactions in them. They're seeing different reactions in us, and we're missing that sweet connection. But not knowing how to say that, hey, I want to connect with you. Let's just sit down for a few minutes. You know, that's much harder to turn away from than somebody that says, where did you go? It was great last year, but all of a sudden we live together, and now, you know, you don't want to talk to me anymore. So what's that about? You know, then that just reinforces it. So if we can learn, and it's a skill, anybody can learn it. If we can learn to know what the argument really is about, we can get to it very quickly and do something to mend it and repair it. Because it's usually not about the groceries, where the car is parked, forgetting the milk, or, you know, even reading the paper when I want to talk to you. It's about something else.
Thank you, Linda. Now, before we, or as we're moving into the decision stage, I'm curious how much willingness or ability must the other person have? Because I realize, and one of the things that I love about your book is that it's about taking responsibility for your side. I think that there was an interview I did a few months ago with Dr. Stan Tatkin, Wired for Love, and which was phenomenal. And it was all about how partners, like how you can watch your partner's triggers and manage your partner. But this is about, which is just as important, if not more so, taking responsibility for your own side of things and managing your own triggers. I don't know where I'm going with this, but okay. So we can put in as much effort as we can, and we can have, obviously nobody's perfect, but let's say you are putting in all these efforts, you're learning these skills, you're watching the triggers, and then the other partner is just still stuck in this cycle of fight or flight, refusing to recover or to catch things or to put in very much effort at all. I mean, at what point do you pack it in if they're not willing to work with you?
You know, that's the big question, and nobody knows. I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question. I've worked with couples who were so triggered and had the biggest messes in their marriages that you could imagine, and somehow they moved through it, and they got into wholehearted. They worked it. I've been with couples where one person didn't want to do anything and was resistant. The other person did a lot of work. And the resistant partner changed. And I've been with couples where it didn't work. It's, you know, there's no, obviously, if you're getting hurt or if your partner is doing abusive, repetitive behavior over and over, then you've got to leave. I mean, you've got to do something to get out of that. That's it, that you can't stay in that. But aside from that, there isn't a rule. You know, there's people make lists and there's books about it. You know, here are the reasons you should stay. Here are the reasons you should leave. I don't believe any of that touches it. I think that there's something in us. It's in our body. It's quiet, and it's a knowing that we have to work out with this person, that we are going to hang in there. And there's also a knowing that says, I'm done, and it's quiet. There's not a lot to talk about when you feel that. It's just, I can't do this anymore. It doesn't come from the head. It comes from another part of us. Because, you know, there's always, we can justify anything we want, but I think that there's an inherent truth that we get to in a relationship, and we can only get to it by clearing out our own pathway to our intuition. And that truth tells us what to do next. You know, sometimes it's a great spiritual practice to hang in there with a partner who you love and who you have a life with, who doesn't get it, who doesn't get what you're doing with yourself, who doesn't get the language or that you're using, and who you know, who you want to get it, quote, but who doesn't. And it's a great practice to just practice acceptance and to not get triggered by what they're doing. And other times, it is harmful to you. It's toxic. But no one can tell you. You got to know that for yourself. What do you think about that?
No, I thank you for clarifying that. I mean, I just recently ended something that was sort of on again, off again, and we were, it just wasn't ever going to go anywhere, and we were trying to maintain sort of a friendship, but it always kind of fell back into the relationship type of situation, and I finally ended it because I felt like I had a moment. All the other times that we'd had big blow-up fights, I'd really contributed to it. In hindsight, I looked and I was like, wow, I really was a jerk. And it doesn't excuse his behavior, but I had to take a lot of responsibility for my part in that. But the last big fight we had, I just took full ownership of everything. And he just attacked and attacked, not physically, but I just realized that.
Verbally, yes.
Yeah. And then I said, this is getting circular. We'll talk tomorrow. And even the next day, he was still, he would have been ready to just sort of let it go, but there was no like responsibility on his part. And for me, I just, like, it was a pattern of behavior that I just couldn't accept anymore. But there was that stillness. And part of that is because I decided not to make any major breakup type decisions when I was in that emotionality.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's right. Not from a reactive place, from a deep response. So what happened?
I haven't spoken to him, and it's been a little bit hard because actually over the weekend I found out that a close friend of mine died of suicide. And so I wanted, of course, and he knew him just very casually. So I have all these thoughts, like I want to reach out, and I really could use someone to cuddle with, but. I think that if I had ended it out of reactivity, I probably would have been much more likely to fall back into it, like I have so many times in the past. And so I feel it's interesting though, because I feel like I've really learned something this time around. But knowing what we were talking about earlier about how we can gain this vivid insight and then lose it again just as easily. So.
Yes.
Hopefully I won't get caught in that same cycle again.
But you're also talking about something else, which is one of the reasons it's so hard to know what to do when we're in a relationship that is painful or not giving us what we need, is that there is always the struggle comes because we're attached to that person. And even though a lot of things might not be working the way we want them to, attachment is still real,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that is, and so your friend committed suicide and you really wanted to reach out and be connected with him because you miss the attachment. And that's why it's so hard to have any kind of straight answers for this. That's why some relationships, which everyone would think would have hit the dust, make it, because people have so much, they're so invested in that attachment, they do the work. And that's why it's so hard to get out of a relationship, even when it's not good for us. Because even though our friends may say, oh, you know, he's a jerk, or we may look at behavior and say, how could I have stood that for so long? There's another part of it, like with the story we were talking about in my book, there's another part of that person that we loved, that we had hopes for. And we long for that part. So it's a very complicated question. It's not black and white, you know, because attachment is something that gets us through the best of times. It calls us to bring out our best. And it also keeps us in relationships that aren't good for us much longer than we should be in it for our well-being. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to bring a lot of compassion to ourselves in those critical times in our relationships when we don't know what to do, because it's not an easy answer usually.
And it's interesting because the attachment also, like you had learned so deeply with Dwayne and Charlene, that everyone has a story. I mean, it doesn't excuse bad behavior, but Dwayne was horribly, I mean, believe he was abused, neglected, all of these things. I mean, he didn't just decide one day to be a jerk. There was
no, that's
reason
right.
for it.
That's exactly right.
And when you have compassion for your partner and you see their wounds, you know, sometimes it's you put up with more than maybe would be good for you because you know where it's coming from.
Well, I think this is the trick, is how we can stay in empathy with everybody, not just with our partner, but to be empathetic and also to have good, clear boundaries. And we get the we really get them confused with each other. You know, having our heart whole for the last stage of this is not about being a wimp and being wholehearted, meaning that you've got a partner who's really doesn't treat you well, and because you're wholehearted, you keep saying that's okay. It means that you have done enough work on yourself where you know how to make a boundary and say, I can love you, and I, you know, love can be unconditional, but relationships aren't. So wholehearted from a strong place is not a codependent whole heart. It's a whole heart that includes me in the loving. And I know that I have to be treated a certain way if I'm going to be with you. And there are people that I can love but choose not to be with because they hurt me. And so in some ways we become tougher with a whole heart, you know, tougher minded, but more empathetic and compassionate in that tough mindedness.
All right. Well, again, I want to put it out there that we are speaking with Linda Carroll. She is the author of Love Cycles, The 5 Essential Stages of Lasting Love. And if you are interested and curious on what love cycle, what stage you might be in, you can go to lovecycles.org and there is a free quiz there. Where's the best place for people to pick up your book?
Well, anywhere. It's in bookstores. It's on Amazon. If they come to my website, they can get an autograph copy, the same cost. And any at Barnes & Noble, you know, New World Library sells it. So wherever there are books, there should be Love Cycles. And I'm also going to be in Seattle on Thursday. But that's a ways from you, isn't it, doing a reading at Third Place Books. And Third Place Books in Lake Forest Park on Thursday night. And I don't, how far, that's several
it's
hours.
It's about a four-hour drive to Seattle from Vancouver. But there may be listeners, and we have listeners all over the world. So if you're there, yeah. And do you have a listing of where you're going to be on lovecycles.org?
Yes, I do. I have a listing of what my tour is. And so I think I have another time in New York and San Francisco. So I'm doing a second round in those places.
Wonderful. Okay, so you can check out lovecycles.org if you want to meet Linda, shake hands, answer or ask some questions. So we were talking about, we talked a little bit about decision. Before we get a little bit deeper into wholehearted loving, is there anything more you want to say about the decision stage?
Well, I think what you said was so smart. To make a decision not in the reactivity of being stuck. You know, there's something which I describe it in the book called infinity loops, and all couples get into these. It's those circular arguments that go round and round. And sometimes you can get stuck in a loop for 10 years. And people want out of the pain of the loop. And sometimes they think they want out of the relationship, but what they really want is out of the pain of the loop. And when you can bust the loop apart, which is possible to do, when that loop can change, you find all the good things about the relationship that you loved from the beginning that are still there. So the doing the work, even though it's counterintuitive when you want to run, doing the work is important, not just because sometimes that can bring back the best of the relationship, but if you leave the relationship, part of that dynamic goes with you because it's your dynamic. And so if you can understand your part of it, you don't have to redo it in the next relationship. So I really encourage people to do their work in the relationship, even when it's hard. Sometimes, especially when it's hard, sometimes people can, and sometimes it's just too much, you know, and that's okay. People, I mean, I don't, you know, we do what we need to do. And so, but that's my first suggestion is let's see what we can do in this relationship. Let's see if we can let go of the relationship that isn't working, but what we can find there. And sometimes that has pretty marvelous results. So the decision is, sometimes people decide to stay, and they decide to just make a parallel life. And that means that, you know, they may have strong family, strong community. They may be working on projects together or have some kind of a common mission. I have that couple that was into saving sea turtles in my book, and they really cared about their joint life, and they didn't have a lot of passion, and there were things that weren't there, but they decided to work it out because they cared about the life, and they just made it a practice of caring about each other. You know, people who sometimes have a pretty good relationship, but they want great passion, may leave and find themselves in a much more unhappy state. So I think it's, you know, there's a lot. Fortunately, we're over the 90s call for the soulmate, that everybody was rushing off to find the perfect soulmate, which is kind of a review of stage one. And so the decision is, it's not bad. I'm not trying to suggest people stay in a parallel relationship, but I'm also saying that that's an okay decision if you can become wholehearted in it and you can live a full life from it. And so, you know, there are people who, they have each other's backs, and they don't have a great deal in common, but they look after each other, and from there, they can be launch places for a big life. So I try not to be judgmental about how everybody has to have a certain kind of relationship. So we can either leave, move into parallel lives, do nothing, which is a choice, sadly, or we can learn the skills that allow us to practice wholehearted love, and we can do that with or without our partner's agreement.
I really love that practice, or the idea at least of the practice, no matter what your partner is doing, because whether you stay or go, it's really ultimately, no matter who you're with, you're still going to need to find that within yourself, find that wholehearted loving. And even if it's not a mutual wholeheartedness, you're doing the practice, and that's impacting you and how you behave out in the world too.
It impacts everything in your life, you know, because part of a practice of wholeheartedness is about learning how to love yourself. And so it, in an ironic way, becoming more wholehearted means that you also have, in some ways, higher standards for what you need in a relationship, because you know you have worth in a new way. So it's sort of ironic, isn't it? And so what is wholehearted? First of all, I want to just say that when I started writing the chapter on wholehearted, I got terribly blocked. I couldn't do it. I was stuck on it for a year. And I talked to a friend of mine. He's a writer, Sam Keen. In fact, he wrote the preface for the book. And I said, Sam, what's wrong? Will you look at this? And he didn't even have to look at it. He said, you can't write about wholehearted until you write about what gets in the way. I thought that was so brilliant. So there's actually two chapters about in the wholehearted section. One is wholehearted barriers, and one is wholehearted bridges. So the barriers to wholehearted are, we have to find out where we are half-hearted, where we're closed-hearted, what our blocks are to being wholehearted. We can't just crash in there, but that there are certain questions we have to ask ourselves and know about ourselves to be able to get to wholehearted. We have to understand the barrier of codependency, and which really gets in the way, and the barrier of a broken heart. You know, sometimes we have been hurt, and we have made a decision we may not even be aware of to not let ourselves try in relationships again. So that's first, is understanding our barriers. And what does it mean to have a whole heart? You know, the communication skills of being non-defensive and the practices of learning to speak from your vulnerability rather than to attack, and all those communication skills about listening and about working out conflict are so important. But when it comes to wholehearted, the skills we need are really the ones that are taught by the wisdom traditions, the skills of forgiveness, empathy, of humor, something I call radical acceptance, the skills of accepting life on life's terms, that no one can meet our needs, that we don't get everything we want, and that our partner is not going to be everything we want, and we're going to have times of being disappointed, or times of wishing for something else. That's a part of life, and it doesn't mean something's wrong. So being able to accept life on the terms that life is rather than how we want it to be, that's another wholehearted skill. Being able to co-create your relationship, learning the skills of collaboration. You know, we fall in love with somebody because we don't see them as weak, we see them as strong. Maybe isn't it wonderful to love someone as strong as we think we are? But how do you learn to collaborate with another strong person? I think that is, boy, that's a big skill. And it's not just about giving in or giving up. It's about really learning true collaboration, which has to do with listening and getting a felt sense of the other person's point of view with empathy, so that you can really speak from their point of view about something rather than the power struggle. It's the antidote to the power struggle. Sexuality, we haven't talked about sex in this, but, you know, sex changes through the whole relationship. In the merge, it's one way, you know, juicy and wonderful and open, and when we go into power struggle and disillusionment, we become more closed off. We become more extreme in our sexual responses. For some people, the power struggle makes them want to have sex a lot because that's a way to connect. And for others, they want to connect first and then have sex. So that in itself can become a power struggle. Often things are pretty cool between people sexually when they get to decision. And how do we bring it back again? How do we use our sexual relationship with consciously that allows for the differences between two people and their sex drives, their stages of life? How do we co-create our relationship in adventure and in lifestyle? And then I guess we go back to how do we get to the place of feeling wholehearted and really feeling like we've arrived in some wonderful place with our partner, and then the sense that we've lost it. Again, where did it go? And what do we do with that? Yeah. So those are questions that I ask. Some of them don't have answers, but they're really an important part of a conversation of relationships, so that we have, in all of our relationships, we have a roadmap with language that we both can share. And it's one of the things that I have gotten so much feedback from people about my Love Cycles book and the class I teach, is that I hear two things about it consistently. One is, I'm so glad I'm normal. I'm so glad that these struggles are normal. And the other is, when you're lucky enough to have a partner who would read the book with you or do the work with you, you get a language. And the language is something that you can use, you know, like, oh, I got, you know, just if you talk about brain, you know, I got triggered. That's such a good way to understand, and a kind of a way of minimizing something that happened. I was triggered and I went into a zone that was pretty crazy, but it really wasn't what's going on. You know, we need language to be able to understand some of the states that we get into, because the person who has the key to our heart also has the key to hurt us the most. So we're going to get into some pretty extreme states in our relationships, and how do we navigate that with wisdom and love? So that's sort of my mission, to try to help people do that.
Mm. Well, I have a couple questions just before we wrap up. Again, we're speaking with Linda Carroll. She is the author of Love Cycles, The 5 Essential Stages of Lasting Love. And you can take the free quiz at lovecycles.org. And I don't know which to ask first, but I guess probably the most important is we can read these books, and I recommend this book for anyone who is in a relationship, wants to be in a relationship, or even if you're not wanting romance, but you want to understand yourself better. I think it's still valuable. But you talk about the language, and we can read these words and absorb the ideas, but learning it and getting it is all about the practice of acceptance and detachment and empathy and all of that.
That's right. It's a practice, and you just think of it as an ongoing practice. But, you know, the more we practice it, the more tolerance we have for the places that we don't do it. And that's part. That's like a meditation practice. People who are longtime meditators generally, not always, of course, nothing's always, but generally have a lot more compassion for the days that they don't meditate, quote, well, whatever that means, because they accept their humanness more and more. And that's one of the things that we get from this practice, and is knowing that, you know, there are days that you're going to lose it. You're going to lose all the things that you've learned about and all of the new counterintuitive moves you've made of empathy, and you're just going to snap. But how do you get back from that? How do you forgive your partner quickly? Because they didn't remember either. And that's part of wholeheartedness, is acceptance that we never get there, that we get bigger and we hold the place longer, but there isn't an arrival of some kind of enlightenment or some kind of wholeheartedness. But when you learn to laugh, it's one of the things I think about in a relationship. When you've lost your humor, you're in trouble. And the faster you can bring that back, then the quicker you're going to get to wholeheartedness. And when you have humor, you can laugh at yourself and your partner, and they can laugh at you. I just suddenly thought that was a bad thing to say.
With you,
maybe you can laugh at yourself. I'll say it like that, or laugh at you together. That's a way that you can get out of it so fast. I mean, humor is so huge in a relationship, don't you? Mm-hmm. Such an important thing.
And it's important just in life in general. I mean, that there's always some kind of crap happening.
Yes.
In life.
Yeah.
It just,
yeah,
doesn't stop. And if you can laugh at it and you can roll with it, and the radical acceptance. And I love what you said about not getting there. I think I'm finally starting to get the acceptance that there's not going to be an arrival.
Right. Right. There's going to be moments that feel like an arrival.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, oh, God, and really great moments when you come up against a loop that you've always gotten triggered in and you don't get triggered. It's like, oh, boy, it really works. But then the next time you get triggered. But that's okay. You know, I guess one of the things, I want to say one more thing, that one of the things in a long-term relationship I talk about over and over is putting in goodwill all the time, keeping that goodwill account out of the red, so that you have something to carry you through the inevitable times that you forget it all. So it's the same thing to nourish our own tank, you know, to know that the days are going to come when we're not going to have a lot in the bank, and our emotional bank, and to be putting in for it for those days.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. And there was also the bridge to generosity, which I wanted to talk about. Maybe we can you sum up what that is in 10 or 20 seconds?
Well, generosity has been called the most important quality in the statistical. I mean, people they've done lots of studies. Generosity is the most important quality in a long-term relationship. And some people have it easily. They're easily generous. Others, it's more challenging to be generous. But we can all learn that. That can be part of the practice. Is that what you wanted me to talk about?
Sure,
how important,
yeah,
generosity is. Letting things go. Good sex. You know, forgiveness. Generosity is in all of that. And certainly it's in keeping the account filled up. And so how do we learn? How do we do that? How do we practice that over and over again? So that when the winter days come, we've got a fire. You know, my husband's brought me a latte every day for 25 years. On days when he doesn't like me, on days when he hands it to me with a kiss, on days when he sort of puts it on the other side of the table, I have to reach for it if he's really trying to punish me. But that latte is money in the bank of goodwill, and it carries us through so many mornings that we are sort of grumpy or we've had a fight. Those acts of goodwill are the mainstay of relationship.
Mm. Oh, thank you so much, Linda. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you. And I hope that imagine if everyone on the planet read your book, what a better world it would be.
Oh, thank you. That's so sweet of you to say. And I really, you know, the book stands on the shoulders of lots of great teachers, too. So it's not just me. It's lots of other wisdom, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. And there is actually a great bibliography there with all of those people referenced as well, so lots more reading. All right. Well, thank you again for your time, Linda. It's been such a pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye. Me too.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, that was Linda Carroll. She is the author of Love Cycles, The Five Essential Stages of Lasting Love. And again, if you want to take that free quiz, you can go to lovecycles.org. I want to send lots and lots of love to you. Have a wonderful week. Be well. I just love you so much. And thank you for taking the time to listen today. I hope that it's brought value to your life. And up next, in just a moment here on CIDR. Oh, sorry. Namaste. You have to namaste.
Namaste.
I can't. I'm not on the ball today. Namaste. Namaste. All right. So up next on CITR is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Horrific.
That's right.
Take care. Bye bye.
Do you need someone to talk to? If you are seeking a listener who is non-judgmental, confidential, and familiar with resources, then a Speakeasy volunteer might be able to help you. AMS Speakeasy is a peer support service located in the North Concourse of the Sub. If you would like to speak to someone, come to the desk and tell a volunteer, or ring the doorbell located behind the desk.
Hi everyone, we're from the UBC Food Society.
Yummy!
And we're the only food club at UBC.
We're about feeding students, but also teaching them how to feed themselves. Through our restaurant outings and cooking workshops, we hope to expose you guys to the diversity of cultures, flavors, and food communities Vancouver has to offer.